What this means is people that use cannabis achieve maximal THC blood levels immediately after an oral, after inhalation. What we also see is their THC blood levels are falling during the acute impairment phase that we talked about, that 20 to 40 minute window. Their levels are actually going down. So we have an inverse correlation between maximal levels of the drug in the system and maximal influence of that drug on person's performance. That's called counterclockwise hysteresis. It means drug effect lags behind maximal drug levels. That's not that unique for a lot of drugs, but it is inconsistent with how alcohol is absorbed. The reason we have per se levels for alcohol is because alcohol does not have this inverse correlation. Maximal blood alcohol levels are positively coincide with maximal impairment of performance. And we have to shift gears and make people understand that's not applicable here for marijuana. You'll also see that carboxy-THC, which is an inert byproduct, it doesn't show up until sometime later. That's because that is what THC is being broken down and absorbed into. So of course it's gonna take some time to show up. And then you see in red is the pharmacokinetics of oral THC. And you see a very different plateau. In fact, you never see any spike whatsoever. So you can have individuals that can be highly impaired by oral THC, but they never have particular high THC blood levels. So again, it shows the limitation of trying to infer behavioral performance from THC blood levels. I'm just gonna go over this really quick and say that as much of you in this room should know, the presence of carboxy THC in urine is not indicative of recency of use or behavioral impairment. So says everyone. You're just not going to find an agency who says otherwise, including NHTSA, who says it is impossible to predict specific effects based on carboxy THC concentrations. And the National Department of Justice says this as well. They say drug tests indicate drug use, but not drug impairment. A positive result, even when confirmed, only indicates that a particular substance is present in the test subject's body tissue, does not indicate recency of use, frequency of use, amount of use, or impairment. In other words, it doesn't answer any fundamental question we would actually be seeking an answer for. Now, a lot of lawmakers have learned this lesson lately, so they say, okay, forget about carboxy THC, let's look at THC in blood. And at one time, it was believed that if there was going to be any way to correlate the presence of this substance in any particular matrix, it was going to be with blood. But as more and more researchers have looked into this and have tried to find whether there's any correlation, they've continually found that there isn't. Again, Robey and his study, this was the study paid for, where they actually gave people marijuana and had them drive. They said one of the program's objectives was to determine whether it's possible to predict driving impairment by plasma concentrations of THC in a single sample. The answer is very clear. It is not. That has been the federal government's position for decades. And I keep hearing, we just need to study this more. Why? Ask and answer. Hartman and Huestis, Marilyn Huestis, who advocates for per se THC blood levels, admits in her own papers there's no direct correlation between driving impairment and THC concentration. Again, this is right from the NHTSA website. They have a fantastic fact sheet that says it is difficult to establish a relationship between a person's THC blood or plasma concentration and performance-impairing effects. It is inadvisable to try and predict effects based on blood THC concentration alone. NHTSA says this right in the DRE training manual. They say we cannot come up with a number that proves someone was impaired unless we're talking about alcohol. And in fact, NHTSA testified before Congress last year and told the House Oversight Committee just this, when they were being grilled. I think lawmakers were stunned. They said, we've got numbers for alcohol. What are the numbers for marijuana? They said, we don't have numbers for marijuana. We probably never will have numbers for marijuana. And again, you know, NHTSA says this over and over again. There's this wide variance between the way people are going to behave under the influence of THC, as I've talked about earlier. And again, I talked about tolerance earlier. I want to highlight this conclusion by Grotenherman and Mueller-Vall. Franjo Grotenherman's paper in addiction in 2008, I believe it was, is where the 5 nanogram estimated per se threshold came from. And that was based on some limited data they did. Grotenherman has since said that you've got to take into account tolerance, because he says individuals that take a consistent dosage of cannabinoids, particularly patients, he says they become tolerant to the impairment of psychomotor performance so they can drive a vehicle safely. That's what the individual whose name is attached to 5 nanograms says about marijuana and driving today. You can drive safely. And the FDA essentially admits this with Marinol. Marinol is oral synthetic THC. And they don't say, if you are taking Marinol, do not drive. They say, do not drive until you are acclimated to the effects of Marinol, until it is established that you are able to tolerate the drug and can perform such tasks safely. There is no scientific theory as to why a person could operate a motor vehicle safely after becoming acclimated to oral synthetic THC, but never become so accordingly acclimated to marijuana itself. And here's an issue that's becoming more and more significant, this idea that you can have residual levels of THC that are identifiable in blood for periods of time that exceed well beyond any reasonable expectation of impairment. Erin Karchner and her crew in Baltimore published a paper several years ago where they found on day 7, 6 days after many of these subjects entered their lab, 6 out of 25 participants still had traceable levels of THC in their blood on day 7 of this study. And then this paper from Odell comes along from 2015 that blows Erin Karchner's numbers away. Because Erin Karchner found very low levels of THC in these individuals for extended periods of time. Odell and colleagues found much higher levels of THC in the blood of these habitual users. They had 21 subjects in the study. 9 of those subjects, so almost half, tested positive for THC at levels above the 5-nanogram standard some 24 hours after they last used cannabis. One subject tested positive above 5 nanograms 129 hours later. Of the 11 subjects who completed the study, because not everybody wanted to have a needle in their arm for 7 straight days, 7 of the 11 tested positive for THC at levels of 2 nanograms or higher. So these people tested positive for levels above 2 for a week after they stopped using cannabis. Several subjects' THC blood levels spiked during what they call the terminal elimination phase. During the period of time these people aren't using marijuana, their THC blood levels are going up. They're not going down. One particular individual between day 3 and day 4 went from 4 nanograms per milliliter on day 3 to 10 nanograms per milliliter of THC on day 4. And there's certain physiological reasons I could give you. I'd be happy to talk with you after the break about why we see these things happening. They said this makes interpretation of toxicological results much more difficult than it has been when it was assumed that THC followed a well-defined pattern of elimination. This is a really important paper. I think I put it in your materials, but if not, again, contact me and I can send it to you. You guys know this. Blood draws, clearly, there's usually a much... there's a time lag that takes place between the blood draw and the focal event. We have no idea what the levels were at the focal event when the blood draw is taken 3 hours later. We can't back extrapolate. This isn't alcohol. About 5 minutes worth of material on field sobriety tests. Field sobriety tests were developed to determine people impaired by alcohol. As we've talked about, cannabis is not alcohol. Cannabis's effects don't manifest the same way that alcohol's effects manifest. They're different classes of drugs. Alcohol or ethanol is a CNS depressant. Cannabinoids are not CNS depressants. They act on different parts of the body and different parts of the brain. It is absurd to think that a test that was designed to determine whether people are influenced by one particular drug would be applicable to determine if people are influenced by an entirely different class of drugs that acts on an entirely different part of the body and manifests itself in entirely different ways. And so not surprisingly, when individuals try to take components or elements of the FSTs and apply them in a double-blind format to people under the influence of marijuana, they have very low success rates. and we see this again and again and again. This is the only study where, in fact, you find the clues, the six clues that individuals look for SFTs for alcohol. These individuals found those clues with individuals who have used marijuana, but it didn't help their specificity at all because they still falsely identified individuals in the study who were actually under the influence almost 60% of the time. So the clues didn't help them a whole lot. And this is the best study the federal government has on this. In a case I was just involved in, we lost a motion to get the FSTs thrown out, and we lost the motion because the judge said this study was so convincing. But we have newer studies that again show you don't even get the clues. This was a placebo-controlled study. They found that overall, subjects' performance on the field sobriety did not discriminate between THC and baseline. So in other words, the individuals performing the FSTs using the clues they were looking for, they couldn't get it right if they were dealing with a sober person or somebody who had used marijuana. Bosker and colleagues tried to recreate this model even in people using oral THC. In this case, they found no significant changes in performance post-dosing on the HGN, on the one-leg stand, on the walk and turn. They said this analysis of the field sobriety test does not reveal any significant effects of dronabinol or cannabis use history. I'll skip the DRE stuff so I can just finish with in conclusion. These are your take-home facts. This is what you need to know. Cannabis may influence psychomotor performance, but this influence is relatively small and short-lived. Cannabis's impact on psychomotor performance differs significantly than that of alcohol. Cannabis's estimated elevated risk is far less than the risk associated with other substances, both legal substances like medications or other illegal drugs. The unique pharmacokinetics of cannabinoids make it largely impossible to correlate impairment of performance with the presence of THC or its metabolites in a single blood or urine sample. Field sobriety tests and DRE evaluations are relatively poor predictors of cannabis-induced impairment. These tests have not been validated for cannabis, and that's in the literature. Every one of the studies I talked about that try to validate for cannabis begin by saying this has not yet been validated for cannabis. That's why they're trying to validate it. And they can't. And then finally, per se, and in particular, zero tolerance per se standards for cannabinoids may inadvertently criminalize behavior that poses little to no demonstrable threat to traffic safety, such as state-sanctioned private cannabis consumption by adults. Those are your take-home messages. These are places you can go to learn a whole lot more about this. And then these are just testimonials from people like you that I've worked with and assisted in these sort of cases. My personal favorite is this testimonial out of Vermont where this particular individual says that in my 24 years of practice, I have never had a state attorney fail to show up for a motion hearing. But in our case, the state never responded to my motion using your report, never identified an expert in response, or ever contacted me about a resolution. The judge dismissed the case for all the above reasons based on the merits of the motion. So those are the sort of ways I can help you. I wrap up with this. Carl Hart, whose work I cited, says this: once you know, you can no longer not know. Well, you folks, now you know. So go and do your due diligence, do your work, and educate those who don't, whether they're judges, whether they're prosecutors, whether they're elected officials. There's a lot of people out there that don't know, but now you do. Thank you.
Thanks, Paul.